For a couple of years, states have been getting billions of extra dollars from Washington to help pay for health care for the poor. Today is the first day they'll have to do without it. Governors have long complained that Medicaid could swamp their budgets, but as NPR's Julie Rovner reports, some of the statistics they've been using may exaggerate the situation.
It's nothing new for governors to claim that Medicaid is wrecking their budgets. Here's Kentucky Democratic Governor Paul Patton back in 2002.
Quite simply, we have at present a crisis in Medicaid that is heading towards catastrophe.
And here's Tennessee Democratic Governor Phil Bredesen in 2005.
I simply do not have the money to keep the program going in its current form.
And not that much has changed. Scott Pattison is executive director of the National Association of State Budget Officers. In a recent appearance on C-SPAN, he explained what the loss of the additional Medicaid money from Washington might mean for strapped states in the coming year.
As a result, they have to go to other areas like K-12 spending to get the money to cover the health care costs.
In other words, states will have to take money away from education in order to spend more on health care. Last year's health law provides yet another Medicaid challenge for states. In most cases, it doesn't allow them to cut eligibility for Medicaid between now and 2014. And all the time, costs keep rising. Here's former Republican Kentucky Governor Ernie Fletcher testifying before the Senate Finance Committee just last week.
Medicaid has grown to consume about 22% of state budgets.
Now, that 22% number comes directly from the National Association of State Budget Officers. But some Medicaid advocates say those NASBO numbers actually overstate how much states spend on Medicaid.
What they're presenting is the total spending that the state does on all of its programs.
Ben Summers teaches health policy and economics at the Harvard School of Public Health.
And then it also includes the fact that revenues are coming from a variety of different sources, state funding, bonds, and then federal spending as well.
And when it comes to Medicaid, he says, those federal revenues account for more than half of the program's funding, even more in poorer states. So what happens to the picture of how much states spend on Medicaid if you subtract out the federal dollars?
Then that number drops to about 12%. And the implication here is that states are spending a lot of their money on Medicaid, but they're spending a lot less than they would be because the federal government is taking up more than half of the tab.
In other words, Medicaid stops being the biggest spending item in state budgets and falls to number two or three behind K-12 and higher education. Summers and other advocates for the program say there's a reason some people want to make Medicaid look as expensive as possible, and it has to do with politics.
So it becomes a potential punching bag for conservatives who are trying to argue that the federal government is overreaching, the Obama administration's health reform is unsustainable, and that the budget numbers just don't add up.
But NASBO official Stacey Mazur says the organization has perfectly reasonable, non-political reasons for organizing its numbers the way it does. Among them are that no matter where the money comes from, states are responsible for its being spent in a prudent way. But she says total spending also paints a more accurate picture of the Medicaid program over time.
And certainly the program is growing, similar to health care overall, at an annual rate of growth that exceeds state revenues or national economic growth, which really leads to budget pressures at all levels of government.
Which means that however you measure it, Medicaid is going to remain a problem going forward. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The latest census numbers confirm a long-term trend in San Francisco. The city is losing young families. It has about 5,000 fewer children living there than it had 10 years ago. As NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports, this exodus is happening even as city leaders are trying to make San Francisco a more attractive place to raise kids.
Susie Williams is a designer of educational toys and mother of two. Not long ago, she and her husband were living in a small North Beach apartment when they had their first son. But when number two arrived, they decided they needed more space.
And, you know, it's something that we thought, we're not going to leave the city. You know, everybody else is going to leave the city when they get kids, but we're not suburban people.
So they bought a three-bedroom condo with more space than they'd ever had before. But raising children in the city is harder than she had imagined. For example, she has to drive out of her neighborhood for school and childcare. On top of that, their mortgage is double what they paid in rent. And the neighborhood can be a little sketchy, she says.
And here I am wanting what they have in the suburbs, wanting a yard, wanting a more of a community. We have a great community in this building, I have to say. There's tons of people with kids, but I think we just need more space. And I feel like I'm selling out saying that.
William's ambivalence is common here. San Francisco is losing children even as it sees an upsurge in births. In fact, it has fewer kids per capita than any other major American city. Hans Johnson is a demographer at the Public Policy Institute of California.
So in some ways, this simply reflects the fact that San Francisco is a dense, older city with a housing stock that is not necessarily very favorable towards families.
Yeah, in the front yard we have cherry tomatoes, some basil, I've got a blackberry bush as well.
Jason Randall is a computer engineer and father of two. He's in his front yard in Oakland, tending to what he couldn't grow while renting a Victorian flat in San Francisco.
We like the city. My wife grew up in New York City. And when we started looking at places with three bedrooms, and then we started looking at prices of houses in San Francisco, we realized pretty quickly that we were just priced out of that market.
And the market is changing the face of San Francisco in more ways than one. The city's African-American population declined by more than 12,000 since the last census. Roughly half were children. Anthony Spears, a parking garage supervisor, left San Francisco about a year and a half ago and took his family to the suburbs.
I got a four-bedroom, two-bath house for the same thing I was paying in rent. I got a little more commute, but it's nothing compared to the price that I was going to have to pay to live here in the city.
It takes an annual salary of more than $200,000 to buy a median price home here, says Margaret Brodkin. She's the former head of the city's Department of Children, Youth, and Their Families.
We have the best child care policies, the best after-school policies. We have one of the highest health care ratings for children in the country, but it can't change the economics of the city.
Several years ago, Brodkin and housing activists promoted policies to make the city more family-friendly, such as requiring developers to build more affordable multi-bedroom apartments with larger laundry and kitchen facilities. The city has made marginal progress, building hundreds of such units, but the need is in the thousands. The other problem, of course, is geography. Confined to a tight peninsula, the city has nowhere to sprawl. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Obama all but hit the roof on the debt ceiling debate this week. At a midweek news conference, the president scolded Congress for failing to reach a deal and effectively held its members after school.
If by the end of this week we have not seen substantial progress, then I think members of Congress need to understand we are going to start having to cancel things and stay here until we get it done.
That part of the scolding seemed to work. The Senate has canceled its July 4th week recess and will stay in the Capitol in an attempt to hammer out a deal. The negotiations were made more urgent yesterday when the Treasury Department said that a deal must be struck by July 22nd to avert a government default by August 2nd. House Speaker John Boehner charged that President Obama has been AWOL himself from the debt limit debate. We're joined now by Mark Zandi. He's chief economist of Moody's Analytics, and he joins us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Mark, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
What do you make of the way the president used the famous bully pulpit this week?
Well, I think he's sounding the alarm bells, and I think he should. I think it's vital that Congress and the administration come together and raise this debt ceiling limit in the next couple, 3 weeks, because if they don't, I think we're going to have a mess on our hands.
Describe that mess.
What will happen is we'll come back from our July 4th weekend. By mid-July, if there's no progress, I think global investors will start getting nervous. They'll attach probability to the possibility that the debt ceiling isn't increased by August 2nd. Mm-hmm. Financial markets will become increasingly unsettled. By the end of July, I think they will be very unsettled. If nothing happens by August 2nd, I think it'll be turmoil. I think interest rates will rise. I think stock prices will fall. I think the dollar will fall in value.
So you take this deadline as real, not just an attempt to focus the mind.
It's very real. I think the Treasury runs out of options and will literally have to balance the budget overnight. And of course, we're running a $1.3, $1.4 trillion annual budget deficit. So that means draconian cuts to lots of everything, Social Security payments, Medicare, everything in between, and I think that would just send the economy into recession.
So what would August 3 look like under this scenario?
Well, come August 3, the Treasury is going to have to start making some hard choices. Somebody's not going to get their money. Now, they probably and it certainly would give IOUs, but the checks would stop flowing. And pretty soon, I think they have a Social Security payment due a few days later. I don't think they would have enough cash to pay all the money they're obligated to those Social Security recipients. So they wouldn't get all their money. They'd get an IOU, but they wouldn't get all their cash. And, of course, the cash problems will just intensify with each passing day, and the cost to the economy, the damage to the economy would mount.
The president sounded a little optimistic at Wednesday's news conference in this sense. Let's listen to what President Obama said.
I think there's a conceptual framework that would allow us to make huge progress on our debt and deficit and do so in a way that does not hurt our economy right here and right now.
Mark, do you share that view?
Yeah. I'm optimistic that policymakers are going to get it together here in time to avert a real problem. I think there is a reasonable amount of commonality between the parties. I think everyone's on board with the amount of deficit reduction we need to do, $4 trillion over the next decade. And I think there's agreement on big aspects of how to achieve that. So I think this is increasingly just a question of politics and not economics. It's a matter of just signing on the dotted line, finding the political will to do that. And I think, when push comes to shove, they'll figure it out.
Does that mean the Democrats have to accept cuts and Republicans have to accept tax increases?
Yeah, I think so. I think we need to find a compromise. I think there's already agreement with respect to sizable spending cuts. I think the debate right now is with regard to tax revenue increases, whether there will be any and what form they'll take.
Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
A lot of people are wondering whether our lawmakers are actually interested in solving problems. For example, this week, members of the Senate Finance Committee were scheduled to meet, and they were supposed to vote on trade agreements with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama. But then, just a few minutes before that meeting was supposed to start, Republicans said they weren't coming. They said they wanted more time to consider those agreements, even though they'd been in the works for a year. Now, Democrats insist that these deals will help the U.S. economy. So do some Republicans, but still, no agreement. So that afternoon, New York Senator Chuck Schumer, who's on the committee, decided to vent, out loud and in public.
They want the country to be in as bad shape as possible because that might help them electorally. All of a sudden, it's sort of like a new fever has taken over the other side, that the best way to win is hurt the country as much as you can, and that will create political benefit. And it's just, it's sad, obviously.
This is Weekends and All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
It's just confounding. I've never experienced anything like it in the 37 years I've been in politics.
Our cover story today, the politics of dysfunctional government and why the president's bully pulpit just isn't as effective as it used to be in forcing Congress to get work done. August 2nd, that's when the Treasury Department says the country will default on its debt unless Congress raises the government's borrowing limit. Right now, that limit is $14.3 trillion. And over the past century, Congress has always agreed to raise the limit when the government was getting close. This time it's different. Congressional Republicans say they'll only consider agreeing if the White House closes the budget deficit by making trillions of dollars in cuts. And President Obama insists he is prepared, as he says, to make painful cuts, but that Republicans will need to accept higher taxes for wealthier Americans.
The Republican leadership in Congress will hopefully sooner rather than later come to the conclusion that they need to make the right decisions for the country, that everybody else has been willing to move off their maximalist position. They need to do the same.
Now, most economists say you can't close that deficit without some kind of tax increase. But that, says Republican House Speaker John Boehner, is a deal breaker.
No tax increases.
Zero.
Zero.
Off the table.
I've made it clear to the president, we're not going to raise taxes. You can't raise taxes on the very people that we expect to invest in our economy and to create jobs.
So here we are at an impasse, and lots of political observers are asking how an otherwise pro forma issue, raising the debt ceiling, all of a sudden became the center of a political showdown. Here's NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson.
What happened was the Republicans got a majority in the House of Representatives in 2010, and many of the new Republicans campaigned on a promise not to raise the debt ceiling. Some Republicans said, I won't vote to raise the debt ceiling unless there are big spending cuts and a path to deficit reduction. Other Republicans said just flatly, I won't raise the debt ceiling. Don't forget, in the past, it's always been a partisan football. President Obama, when he was in the Senate, voted against raising the debt ceiling and said it because he thought it was a symbol of a failure of leadership on the part of the Republican president. So this has been a partisan football. However, the party in the majority usually swallows hard and votes to raise the debt ceiling, because if it's not raised, the United States will default. And our credit rating, in effect, in the international financial community will be wrecked.
Let's talk about the political strategy here. Let's say the U.S. did default. Is there a plausible chance that congressional Republicans could successfully pin the blame on the president and say, look, he wasn't willing to compromise with us about cutting spending down, and we're not going to raise your taxes, and we're in default because the president was unwilling to work with us?
The answer to that question is unknowable, and that's what makes the political dance here so difficult. It's impossible to know for Republicans if, in fact, the country defaulted, would the president take the blame? If, as he put it at that press conference, all of a sudden the United States is in the position where they have to choose between paying interest on our debt to China or paying people's Social Security checks, would he be able to pin the blame on Republicans at that point for blocking the debt ceiling? Or would they be able to blame him? That is something that's impossible to game out. It's really playing with fire. And this has never happened before. And that is why the leadership in Congress, particularly in the House, the Republican leadership, have said all along that the debt ceiling will be raised.
Mara, are there any Republican political strategists or even, you know, lawmakers who have implied or would maybe say that in some ways dysfunctional government could help the cause of conservatives, could actually help Republicans, because in a sense it affirms this idea that government is the problem?
Well, it's true that when there's gridlock, which is one form of dysfunctional government, when the president can't get things done, can't get things through Congress, he looks less effective. And in that sense, dysfunctional government or gridlock always helps the opposition party. But we don't really have a pure opposition party right now, because Republicans are in charge of one House of Congress. So it's a little more complicated. We went through this before when we had a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, and a Republican Congress, and there was gridlock, there was a government shutdown, and the Republicans ended up getting blamed. And Republicans I've talked to in Congress aren't so sure that if things come to a total impasse on this debt ceiling debate, that they'll be the ones who come out looking good. It's impossible to know. That's why the stakes are very high here and the politics are very hard to calculate.
That's NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Mara, thanks.
Thank you, Guy.
Now, President Obama revealed some of his frustration at the impasse earlier in the week during a news conference. He even drew a parallel between members of Congress and the homework habits of his own daughters.
They don't wait until the night before. They're not pulling all-nighters. They're 13 and 10. You know, Congress can do the same thing. If you know you've got to do something, just do it.
Now, not too long ago, historian Julian Zelizer says this sort of thing might have worked for a president. If he felt Congress wasn't cooperating, he'd just stand in front of a microphone somewhere, usually the White House, and instantly millions of Americans would hear his message. And the master of the bully pulpit? Ronald Reagan.
Who in 1981, just after he becomes president, wants to persuade Congress and the nation to pass a tax cut, a huge tax cut, and to cut government spending.
I'm speaking to you tonight to give you a report on the state of our nation's economy.
Before speaking to Congress, he makes a television address where he decides he's just going to circumvent Congress and start by talking directly to the American people.
Here is a dollar such as you earned, spent, or saved in 1960. And here is a quarter, a dime, and a penny. 36 cents. That's what this 1960 dollar is worth today.
And it worked. President Reagan got his tax cut. So the bully pulpit, the idea that the president commanded the attention of the media and the public, used to be among his most powerful tools. It worked for Truman and Johnson and Reagan and even President Clinton. But those days, says Julian Zelizer, are gone.
I think in the modern age, the president speaks, most channels aren't showing what he is saying. And so it's very difficult for a president to command the same attention. Congress is also so polarized right now, I just don't think the strongest presidential message can really move the parties. It might be that President Obama is not effective, or it might be, more realistically, this is really all a president can do. President Bush had the same complaints often. He was telling Americans what he was doing, and he said they didn't hear him or they didn't understand. This might be all that's available to a president in 2011 and 2012.
Historian Julian Zelizer. So what about that idea that the president may not be able to do a whole lot to persuade either the Congress or the public? Well, if that is the case, isn't there an argument to be made that gridlock is a good political strategy for the president's opponents? Brian Kaplan is a political economist at George Mason University in Virginia and the author of the book The Myth of the Rational Voter.
It is quite likely that Obama will bear more of the blame for things not going well than the Republican House. And so actually, if Republicans care about their party getting the presidency next year, it might be better for them if things don't improve.
Why would the president get blamed rather than congressional Republicans?
Well, for that, you kind of have to ask voters. All I can say is that it seems like presidential elections are more sensitive to economic conditions than congressional elections. And again, probably it's because of the mutual finger pointing. And somehow, when everybody points fingers at everyone, the fingers of the president seem more convincing than fingers pointed at Congress, even though it's probably a pretty mixed bag.
So essentially what you're saying is that the Republicans who say, look, government is the problem, it's not the solution, that is their philosophical view. If, in fact, they ensure that government cannot resolve problems, they're just kind of affirming their philosophical view.
Could be. Again, of course, they might be right. It might be that what Obama's proposing is a bad idea. Of course, in 2008... McCain, according to betting markets, was ahead in August and looked like he was going to win, and then everything tanked, and it seems pretty clear it was good for Democrats that it did tank.
Do you really think voters are irrational, or could it be that they're busy living their lives and just not paying a whole lot of attention?
So one of the main things that I say in the book is if people were just not paying attention, things would be fine. Because if people who didn't know what they were talking about didn't pay any attention, then politicians wouldn't have to worry about their views on things, and they could just focus on winning over people who actually know what the facts are. One of the main problems with democracy is that people who don't know what they're talking about still have opinions, very strong opinions, and they vote on them. And if politicians try to go against that and say, well, most Americans believe this, but they're wrong, they tend to lose very badly.
So how does that relate to what we're seeing now with the gridlock over raising the debt limit?
Right. Well, I think a lot of gridlock is based on the fact that on the one hand, there's a lot of very popular programs. And just as a matter of math, there's a bunch of things, something has to give.
In other words, people like Social Security and Medicare, but
right.
Nobody
those
wants
are the big programs and the rapidly growing programs. They don't want taxes to go up, and they don't want deficits either.
That's political economist Brian Kaplan. Tomorrow on this program, we'll take a look at the economic consequences of not cutting a deal. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.